So we will begin today's discussion. So today I plan to do Landau's theory of phase transition, which is a phenomenological theory, and it's a very friendly theory, and manipulations are very easy and it's very successful. And then after that, if I have time, I will try to go to the Ising model in two dimension that I started, then try to finish it. But before that, I will begin talking about a very important topic in phase transition, namely renormalization group. It turns out it's a very, very powerful method to understand critical phenomena and also non-critical phenomena. And you learn renormalization in quantum field theory from a different perspective, from a different point of view. Here it's something very practical. You are forced to evaluate some many-body partition function. And then in particular, you are forced to understand critical phenomena. How can you go about doing it? And all these things were started by Kadanoff and Weidem and so on. And then a very powerful program started with Wilson on the one hand, somewhat like field theory, then going to momentum degree space and eliminating degrees of freedom. There was another program that was started by Kadanoff and others looking at real space phenomena, that is, looking at degrees of freedom in real space and how they coarse grain at different length scales. So we will see all those things in the next three lectures in some detail. So I will start with a very simple, friendly, one-dimensional example today. It's the second part of my talk. So yesterday, I discussed the mean field theory. I said that it can be discussed in two ways. One is using the self-consistency condition. Another is through a very simple, solvable model in which a spin is interacting with every other spin. Then you can do mathematics exactly. And then lo and behold, at the end that you find you get an expression for partition function. Please recall that I started with this Hamiltonian. And you can apply magnetic field if you want. Now, this Hamiltonian, when you plug it in and then introduce an auxiliary variable and then integrate over the spins, and you got some very nice function. Then, in particular, this free energy had a form when you look at it close to the point at which this is maximum, because you have a large number n, which is a macro like Avogadro number, and then free energy per spin, you can do saddle point approximation. That amounts to locating the maxima of this function. And this function, having located the maxima close to the point, it looks like m square t minus tc plus some lambda m to the power of 4, which is so. Then what we did was we just minimized this function with respect to m. So what is remarkable here is a friendly statistical mechanical system where finding equation of state, the relation between magnetic field, external magnetic field, and the equilibrium value of magnetization that you get, which is the equation of state, just by minimizing a very simple function. And if you recall, thermodynamics, where we had very simple equation of states like Boyle's law, as well as the equation of state that van der Waals gave. they were written down. Boyle's law was just written down, and then it was never derived. Then came Gibbs' statistical mechanics, and he could derive it. Similarly, van der Waals' equation of state was written down based on physical consideration, saying that a particle, a molecule that forms a gas or a liquid has a finite volume, so it excludes others from coming in its neighborhood. So that leads to a reduction in the specific volume, that is, volume occupied by a particle. And then also, there is an attraction among particles, which will lead to reduction in the effective pressure. So that was a phenomenological motivation. We never obtained this equation of states by minimizing something. So it will be wonderful if we can find a way to obtain equation of state or relations among physical quantities in equilibrium from some minimization principle. So this is what Landau achieved. So that question never came in the context of gas and liquid because the system was so simple. Even though it exhibits things like critical phenomena, there is nothing like a symmetry breaking. There is nothing like an order parameter that characterizes liquid and gas separately. Both are homogeneous phases. Somehow, the difference between them vanishes as you walk along the critical point and then the end point, which you have seen several times. So something interesting happens here. This is liquid here, and this is gas. As you walk along this line, the difference between liquid and gas vanishes here. So there was no question about minimizing certain things and getting it. But it turns out, by going to Gibbs' description, that is, defining Boltzmann factor and integrating over all points in phase space, you can get something like this. So I will do that now today. Yesterday I did it for spin system. It turns out you can do this for general systems in which spins are not interacting with long range interaction, just having nearest neighbor interaction. But the message I'm going to take from here is that it is possible to write down a thermodynamic function by identifying key variables and then minimize this with respect to relevant variable and find out equation of state. So this is a message that we get from here. And Landau elevated it to a theory through his very simple and beautiful analysis. So if you look at this expression for free energy that I have, that mean field theory gave me, this free energy, suppose I drop magnetic field to begin with, reflects the symmetry of the problem. Because I started with an Ising model, so my free energy should be independent of the direction of spontaneous magnetization. So that is beautifully satisfied here. You replace m by minus m. So the form of the free energy remains the same. Then another important thing you notice is that every input here on the right-hand side is analytic. That is, I have a function which is a simple analytic function of m square. Like, m square, if I have a magnetic field, I have m and m to the power of 4. And similarly, the deviation from critical point, t minus tc, is also just a linear power. So this fact that we see in the simple mean field theory, Landau abstracted it into a general principle. He said that if I look at a phenomena, look at a system in which there is a phase transition. Now we go beyond liquid and gas. I will give some very specific example of in the solids and other places where the order parameter or the relevant, here in the case of liquid and gas, the relevant variable is basically specific volume. And the conjugate variable is pressure. So in this problem, the relevant variable is magnetization. And what could control that is external magnetic field. So now, within staying within the example of magnetism, I may like to have a situation in which the magnetic moment is not a scalar like what I have. For example, if you take a ferromagnet like iron, the magnetic moment or magnetization can point in any direction. There may be some weak preference for certain crystallographic direction. So to begin with, if I want to talk about theory of phase transition in ion, or if you want to study equation of state of magnetization as a function of field at a given temperature, I have to define a vector order parameter. Then when I write down a free energy, this vector order parameter should reflect the fact that I have rotation invariance in spin space. That means it should have a form very simple, nothing dramatically different from here. So this will start discussing a ferromagnet in which the order parameter, this is called an order parameter, is a vector. It's very trivial generalization from here to here. But there are odd, yes.
Should the first bracket, the n times m really have a square?
Thank you. No, no square, yeah. So there are situations in which the order parameter is a little more complicated than this. You all know liquid crystals.
So
basically, it's made up of long molecules. So it's not spherical molecule. So that simple difference leads to profound modifications of phases of liquid crystals, a so-called pneumatic phase, and a smectic phase, and so on. So it's obvious that in order to describe phases of liquid crystal, a simple vector will not do, because basically I have a rigid body which has an orientation and it can organize itself in complicated form. So it turns out, in order to describe a liquid crystal, I will not go into the detail, you need what is called a tensor order parameter. So that is, it's a number which has two indices. These indices, alpha and beta, are related to x and y direction. Then here, what did I do? I input rotational invariance in spin space and construct my free energy guided by this example, saying that it's a very simple analytic function of m dot m and m dot m whole square, and then t minus tc. So when I go to more complicated orders, I have to construct invariants which are scalars, or which are invariant under rotations of this rigid body. So in the case of liquid crystal, you will find that there are invariants like this alpha, beta, and then there are invariants which involves three q's. So the free energy you construct will be functions of those invariant objects. So that is basically Landau's idea. Then you can have a situation in which there is a coupling in the system, namely this magnetization, with some other order parameter. In fact, there are situations in which this, in liquid crystals, you can imagine those liquid crystals, molecules having magnetic moment. And there are so-called ferrofluids in which the local entity that are there carry finite magnetic moment. So there is a coupling between that order and orientational order. So you have to construct invariants properly. So when you go to more complicated cases, you get beautiful classifications, group theory, and everything coming in a very nice way. So I will not go into the details today, but I will just point out that this is the spirit of Landau's theory. Just whatever we learn from a very simple Ising model, that is, the free energy that we minimize, in this case by looking at this saddle point, better have the full symmetry of my original problem. Then it better be analytic. And of course, because of this, the result I will get will be mean field theory like. But in many problems in solid state physics, it is sufficient to have a good understanding of what are all the phases that are going to appear and what kind of different critical phenomena that is going to appear. So this approach is, in that sense, very humble. But then you can take this as a basis and then go beyond. which is what, in fact, we will do when we look at phase transition from field theory point of view. You can elevate this free energy into some kind of action. And then here, I have assumed that this M is a collective variable. It's independent of space. So I have identified some mean magnetization, and I'm trying to determine it self-consistently or by this minimization procedure. But in real life, particularly when you go to critical point, this M will start wildly fluctuating at different points. So how do you control that? Then you'll have to modify the free energy, involve gradient terms. I will come to that. Then it will start looking like 5-4 field theory. And then I can do calculations and so on. So now, the power of this simple theory is already, you know, historically important in trying to go beyond simple critical point. Because when we studied liquid and gas, we focused on one critical point. But there are situations in which there is a line of critical point which ends as a first order transition. In fact, I will give two well-known examples, and then from there go on. So we can understand standard critical point. In fact, I will say how to generalize Landau's theory to understand the phenomena of what is called tricritical point. What is a tricritical point? It's very simple. If we take certain magnets, some of the well-known magnet is, and look at, it's a ferromagnet. So if you have zero magnetic field, you have the canonical behavior. Let's say you have applied some external pressure to the system. Then what you find is the magnetization comes down and vanishes at a critical point. So there is a critical phenomenon going on. So this is a well-known second order phase transition. So this is when the pressure is very large. When you release the pressure, something interesting happens. Below a pressure, this order parameter is not vanishing. It is dropping discontinuously to zero. So now you have a control parameter, namely physical pressure applied to the solid. As a function of this pressure, what was a continuous phase transition suddenly become a discontinuous phase transition. So if I go to this phase diagram, let's see, the amount of discontinuity here, let me call it a delta M, as a function of pressure, at low pressure it was finite, and then it vanished. So here you have standard, so if I sit at the critical point, so I'm sitting at T equal to TC, and I find that there is no discontinuity, and from below, the discontinuity starts building up. Now, I would like to get a theory that describes this. You can go to a microscopic theory like Spinhoff Ising model and the lattice gas and do that, but we will not do that. We will follow Landau's phenomenological approach and find out how a second order phase transition can change into a first order transition by tuning some parameter. It's a very simple game in minimizing some simple function. So in order to do that, let's go back to I should have organized it properly at the beginning. It's okay. So please remember that yesterday, while doing it, I said that this free energy function in the absence of magnetic field for T greater than TC has a form like this. It's locally quadratic, but then at large, you remember the form of M, Fm is M square T minus TC plus lambda M to the power of 4. So when T is greater than TC, at small m, this quadratic term dominates, at large m, this starts dominating. So you have a locally parabola, then which becomes steeper. So that's at t equal to tc, so it becomes t to the power of, so the parabola, it's not a parabola, it's much flatter, and then it goes very high. So t equal to tc. And then we notice that below tc, you have this behavior. So it being a very simple algebraic equation, you can find out this location of this minimum at every t below tc. So there we get this equilibrium value, that equation, that m as a function of temperature has this behavior. Now we want to have a situation in which it starts jumping. So Landau's theory suggests a very simple modification, because it's, after all, a phenomenological theory. I want to write down a form of free energy as a function of the conjugate variable m and h, such that I get a minimum, get a jump. So the only modification I need is some alpha times m to the power of 6. So I am looking for a change from first order to second order phase transition. So first I would like to get first order transition. So it turns out, and also I want to get a tricritical point at which a first order transition terminates in a second order transition. So now it's very clear that you'll have to play with this and t minus tc to affect it. If lambda is positive, nothing much interesting happens from this term alpha, because we will see that in most of the discussion alpha is positive. So this is only going to make some small corrections. But things start becoming interesting, and you start getting first order phase transition if you start making lambda negative. So schematically, now this is very simple. Now what do I do? I minimize this free energy. And when I minimize it, I basically get, like, let me do it explicitly. So traditionally, people put a 4 here, put a 6 here, at least to have the first derivative term simple. Here they put a half m into t minus tc plus lambda m cube plus alpha m to the power of 5. So when I minimize, it is equal to 0. I will have to take second derivative and look at the value of that at the minima, at the optimal point, to say whether it's a maxima or a minima. But let me at the moment concentrate on this. So this is very simple. You have t minus tc plus lambda m square plus alpha m to the power of 4. So this is a quadratic equation in m, and you can solve it, because I have cancelled one. So there is always one solution. So this equation has 5 solutions, 5 roots. But m equal to 0 is a trivial root, which I have cancelled. So I have 4 solutions. So when you do the analysis of these roots, the following thing happens. That is, now what I am doing is I am keeping alpha positive, and t minus, this coefficient depends on whether I'm below or above tc, and then I'm going to change lambda, the sign of lambda. When I have change in sign of lambda, then, so in my mind, I have t axis here. So this is tc, I'm walking across. So when lambda is positive, I have height at high temperature, a single minimum, and then I have double minimum at low temperature, indicating that there is a spontaneous magnetization. So I'm just drawing a curve of free energy as a function of m. So these are all the equilibrium value at low temperature. This is the equilibrium value at high temperature. And that Tc, of course, as you know, it becomes rather flat. So it goes as m to the power of 4. So now, along this line, I slowly start playing with lambda. I change the value of lambda to lower and lower value. So let's see first what happens when I come to negative value of lambda. You can immediately see that there are new roots now. So this free energy will start at very high temperature. So now there are roots. M equal to 0 is root. Other things are plus and minus m. So there is a new stable minimum, which was the previous one. Now the fact that this has negative value says that the system will try to come down because the so when lambda becomes negative, it is m to the power of 4. So it will pull it down. And once m becomes larger, this will pull it up. That's why you have this. But now you have this remarkable possibility that when you walk along this line, you have, at the critical point, a situation in which these two minima descend down and just become degenerate with these two minima. So now the system has to choose. It can be here, which is a paramagnet, or it can be here. So then the change happens discontinuously. Because and this minima was living above. At this critical point, the minima becomes degenerate. So the system can jump or phase separate from here to here. And then when you come below, you will have this minima goes up, and we have possibility of magnetization M. So now if you follow this line, the order parameter will have a jump. So if you follow here, the order parameter has no jump. So now it's very clear by looking at extreme cases, namely lambda positive and large, and lambda negative and large, you have two situations. So it's now obvious, and the algebra is straightforward when you look at the roots of this, that as you change this parameter lambda, there is a point at which you go from this to this. So the critical point ends in a first order point. So this is a very beautiful, so in fact, after Landau's theory, the phenomenology of these things became very, very clear. Since I'm a condensed matter physicist, I will give you one well-known example, something that we are all familiar with, ammonium chloride. It's a salt which is used for some medicinal purposes. I just learned today, we're looking at Wikipedia, that squids, the giant squids, managed to live in seawater and work against buoyancy by having ammonia in its body. If you take a standard fish, apparently there are cavities which contain air, which manages it floating, whereas giant squid have liquid ammonia. And that's one of the reasons why people don't like the taste, because it has ammonia taste. I don't know what is ammonia taste, but apparently it's not good. OK, so let me describe the phenomenology, because some of you may start thinking about real system. It's very simple and beautiful. So that's why I will tell you. Because after all, we do statistical mechanics to understand real system. And this is one very nice real system. Ammonium chloride, like sodium chloride. So effectively, if you think in terms of charges, chlorine grabs an electron, then ammonium loses an electron, ammonia. And then once ammonia loses an electron, it is like electronically CH4. Because you remember, nitrogen, yes?
Sorry, what does lambda physically represent in
that experiment? OK. At the moment, it's a phenomenological parameter. So I will choose lambda to fit with the experiment. The same way in the Van der Waals equations of state, the parameter B. And where is it? Somewhere hiding here. Yes, OK, this is a very important point. So when Van der Waals did the equation of state, he didn't have advantage of all these Gibbs free energy calculations. And so he said that I will take classical ideal gas equation of state, and I will modify it by hand so that it fits with the experiment. So he took variety of solutions, and you know, gas, liquid, of variety of systems. Then for every system, you have some parameter. So this is called phenomenological theory. You don't calculate it from microscopics. Sometimes you may be able to make estimates of those quantities. So it's exactly in the same sense. This is a phenomenological theory. I did not tell what is TC. TC is number. For example, when I come to this ammonium chloride, TC will be around 250 Kelvin. Then correspondingly, the lambda will have some number. So at the moment, they are phenomenological parameters. But for a reasonable range of those parameters, lambda positive and negative, this theory captures possibility of first order phase transition and second order phase transition. So that is the spirit that we do. OK. So you know, in the periodic table, carbon is here and nitrogen is here, and then oxygen and so on. Here is boron. So when nitrogen gives away an electron, it basically becomes like carbon as far as electrons are concerned. So it becomes like ammonia molecule, a tetrahedrally bonded molecule. So the structure is very beautiful and simple. So chlorines sit at the corner of a cube. Now, you can very well immediately guess where ammonia will sit. Sodium sits here. And then there are four hydrogen atoms, sorry, not sodium, ammonia sits here. And there are four hydrogen atoms sticking out. And they are like pointing towards corner of a tetrahedra. Is this all something that you know? For example, in methane, you have CH. Now, if you look at a cube, in fact, you can form a tetrahedron in a cube by imagining this and this. So what I have done is I have taken a line connecting these diagonal sides on the upper face. I have taken the corresponding complementary diagonal in the lower face, and I connect them. And I have six bonds, and the center of the cube is a tetrahedra. So this is one tetrahedra I can form. So in one form, what happens is, now I can use. So ammonia is sitting here, sorry, sodium, nitrogen atom. And then along this bond, a hydrogen sits. And along this bond, another hydrogen sits. And where is the other one? Yeah. Then along this, hydrogen sits. And then along this, another hydrogen. So locally, it's a tetrahedron. So yes. No, no. It's maybe I'm making it look more complicated. So I take a simple cube. I want to put an ammonia at the center, the most symmetric possibility. And ammonia, this NH4 molecule, not ammonia, NH4 molecule is a tetrahedron. So two of the hydrogen that stick out point towards these two atoms. Okay? And then other two hydrogen atoms point towards the bottom two. So believe me, if you just sit down and do it, you can imagine two types of tetrahedron to be inscribed in a cube. One is what I have drawn. Let me do it again. Now I connect this. So this is a tetrahedron, right? So this is what I have drawn. OK, sorry. This I have drawn the other tetrahedron, that is, OK. So ammonia can take two states in this cubic environment. It can, NH4, nitrogen atom can sit here. The four hydrogen atom can point towards these four atoms, this, 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 and this. So the complementary four is here. So it's like an Ising variable. So if I want to describe the state of this system, state of NH4 molecule, I will call this as a pseudo spin, which is up, and pseudo spin, which is down. Okay? Now you can imagine, when you look at the energetics, that it is favorable for ammonia molecule in neighboring elementary cubes to be in the same tetrahedron or in the same state. If they are in the opposite, there will be some strain. So there is an energy involved. So if you model this, it becomes exactly like an Ising model. But what is remarkable is experimentally, people find that if you look at this order parameter, so I said it's like a spin, mean value as a function of temperature. At room temperature, that TC is about, not room temperature, 242 Kelvin, it has a first order jump. Take the same thing and apply a pressure, this amount of discontinuity goes and then it becomes a second order. So very simple system, which has been now thoroughly studied using Landau's theory. So a line of, as a function of pressure, external pressure, you have a line of critical point ending in a line of first order transition. So this is called tricritical point. And as you can imagine, as I showed in the this the critical behavior, for example, will be very different when I'm at the tricritical point. Because previously, the standard critical behavior essentially said that a single minimum splits into two minima. That is the standard critical phenomenon. Deep in the first order, there are three minima which is fighting. Now, at the tricritical point, there is a new degeneracy. So if you calculate critical exponents and so on, which I will not do, I have no time, it will be very different. So this shows the power of Landau's theory, just inspired by mean field theory. Now you have added extra terms. So what is guiding you is that you construct free energy, which is simple and analytic in order parameters, which respects the symmetry of the original problem. Then things like symmetry breaking comes as different solutions below some low temperature. So spontaneous symmetry breaking is very manifest in this particular case. Yes.
Yeah. What is the quantity that people are actually measuring? Like you.
So, what is the quantity I'm measuring? For example, I can do neutron scattering. So, there is no normal. You know, if I had given another example, since you are asking this question, there is a famous example called barium titanate, which is supposed to be a ferroelectric. So there, what happens is, you have a barium atom sitting here. Titanium atom sitting here. And these are all oxygen atoms. So below transition temperature, what happens is this titanium atom moves up, for example. Then it induces a dipole moment. So experimentally, what you see is you measure polarization of this system. As a function of temperature, you find below a critical temperature, the polarization starts building up. So there is a spontaneous polarization, electric polarization, like spontaneous magnetization. Now here it is a little more subtle because there is no simple dipole moment associated with it. Because this is in some sense a symmetric molecule. So you could measure some strain that is arising from this ordering. So you could measure some elastic properties, and the elastic constants will follow how much ordering I have of this NH4 molecule. So there are consequences of local ordering. Or if you want to do a straightforward thing, you can do neutron scattering experiment. Neutron scattering tells you the orientation of this ammonia molecule, whether it is in this way or in this way in detail. Yeah.
Isn't the two orientations equivalent when I rotate the second one by 90 degrees?
Exactly. So they are symmetry related. I leave it as a homework. So these two or symmetry equivalent. You can go from here to here by a 90 degree rotation along many directions. In fact, that's the kind of thing that you do when you build a Landau's theory. Suppose I want to do more sophisticated Landau's theory, then the octahedra starts distorting, the tetrahedra. Then that needs to be taken into account. Here I'm just talking about two tetrahedron possibility. But if the tetrahedron starts distorting, it can distort in four directions. Then I will start getting order parameter with different components. So I have to construct corresponding symmetry invariant combinations, which I will not do. So this is the, okay. So this is Landau's theory. And in fact, it has become so important these days. Many people call it as Landau potential in people doing field theory. And the famous Higgs mechanism has this kind of Landau free energy. Let me explain that. So there, as you know, when you do Higgs mechanism, you have a complex field. So there is a mass term. And this Higgs field couples to other things. I will not talk about it. Will not think about it. But what is interesting is that this action, that is local action density, has the Mexican hat behavior. Because if phi is a complex quantity, then you can draw phi in the, you know, phi real and phi imaginary. Then you'll have a Mexican hat, and so on. So, and this is a very simple Landau free energy, but in the con. Sorry. Yeah. No. This is V of phi. Yeah. Thank you. So the is that axis V of phi, and I'm plotting.
Why
can't you do the Landau's expert
with time dependent field?
Yes, okay. So Landau never worried about time to begin with, because he wanted to understand, like, liquid, gas, van der Waals theory, equilibrium states of ordered system. Then, in the context of superconductors, Ginsberg, who was a student, joined him, and they said that can we elevate this minimization procedure into something dynamical, using very general gauge invariance argument. And they did some very beautiful work, which said the order parameter for a superconductor they postulated before BCS theory is a complex number. And then they also postulated that this order parameter or this order carries some charge. So it can couple with the external electromagnetic field in a minimal way. So that's a famous Ginsberg-Landau action. And then they also said that there can be time-dependent phenomena. So they explicitly introduced some dynamics for these Cooper pairs. And that's a famous Ginsberg-Landau theory. In principle, you can do that. But in equilibrium statistical mechanics, we'll be satisfied with time independence. I have not even gone to time dependence, position dependence. Yes.
In the equilibrium system, we cannot deal with the dynamics.
We can, in principle. No. Then you'll have to have more classes, more hours. So that was the idea of Boltzmann. For example, what we see experimentally is an equilibrated system. So can we talk about starting with some non-equilibrium configuration, it reaching some equilibrium? So he wrote down Boltzmann's equation and then solved it approximately and did find that the equilibrium distribution at long time scale will be like a Gibbs Boltzmann, governed by Boltzmann distribution for interacting systems and so on. So in principle, we can do it within statistical mechanics. Then that goes into kinetics. If I have time, maybe in the last class, I will talk about it. So at the moment, it's all equilibrium phenomena. The same way thermodynamics, including van der Waals theory and so on, dealt with equilibrium phenomena. If at all there was time dependence, they were doing adiabatic changes, like, you know, putting a piston and then doing some work and seeing how things change. It was never fast dynamics. It was never real dynamics.
Current, But like when we have time dependent order parameter, how can we get this that slow of dynamics? Like can we still use the minimization principle to get the dynamics of the system?
Okay, that's a good question. So then
it becomes like when we do classical mechanics, you have kinetic energy term and potential energy term. So in a classical system, we first minimize the potential energy. For example, if you have a collection of hot spheres, if you minimize the potential energy, you get some. It's a cubic lattice or FCC lattice. Then you input dynamics. And then you can, in principle, write down dynamical equations for order parameter, phenomenologically. The same way I did for Landau theory, I can say that this order parameter satisfies first order dynamics or second order dynamics. And that's a whole field, how to derive dynamics of order parameter and dynamics of macroscopic observables from microscopics. So there is a whole field of, so this is what I wanted to do as far as Landau theory is concerned. Now, in some sense, this is the first step towards doing renormalization group in momentum space. In fact, David will do that. Because now, until now, I treated this free energy as a phenomenological thing. Now I can elevate it further and say that I can think about it like an action. Right now, there is no space information available. It's very clear. I'm talking about some mean order parameter. I assume that it's not varying in space. But it's very clear to all of us that if I take a magnet and then create a change in magnetization profile by some external means, it should cost energy. It's like elasticity. Suppose I take a solid and then try to twist it, it will cost energy. And the amount of energy I spent is related to elastic constants. Suppose try to pull it, it will cost energy. So in principle, within this very simple and humble approach, I can try to input spatial variations in order parameter and how the system responds if I tries to apply, for example, a magnetic field locally. One is uniform magnetic field, which we understand through this. Suppose I try to apply magnetic field locally. For example, you can do these days experiments in which you have some scanning tunneling tip which carries magnetic moment. You can distort the local magnetic field and so on. So there is a beautiful and simple generalization of this whole idea, not starting from microscopic variable like Ising spins and so on, just phenomenologically. That is the next step. Again, you can go a long way with this approach and calculate quantities. So if I take a magnet, so you know there is some average value of magnetization. So I try to create a gradient. It is going to cost energy because if you think microscopically, some number of spins have to be done. So that means I have a local exchange energy which is not satisfied. So I have to, like for example, if you look microscope, suppose this length scale is very large compared to lattice parameter, namely A. Microscopically, in order to achieve a dip in magnetization, I need to have some configurations in which some spins are down somewhere else, and so on. So that causes energy because here I spent an energy 2J, here I spent energy 2J. So how do I represent it mathematically? So now, previously I had the free energy per particle. Now what I will do is, I will say that there is a free energy density. So the simplest way to account for change in energy when there is a gradual variation is through a gradient term. Okay. So I say that, and then it's obvious that the energy is going to be independent of the direction of the gradient. So the simplest thing I can do is, now there has to be some characteristic energy here because there is a stiffness of this order. I could have done the same thing, for example, for the liquid gas also. I try to create a local density change. There will be some stiffness which is related to compressibility. So here there will be some stiffness related to some local susceptibility. So let me call it as A1. and then I keep the rest the same. So already I have, so that means I have a profile of M of R. This expression of Landau gives me the energy of that magnetization profile. Okay. Now you will clearly see that these are all parameters. A will depend on temperature. Tc is already here, and some of this lambda will depend on temperature phenomenologically, because I'm not doing any microscopic theory. I am looking at a magnet which is given to me, which I'm sitting close to critical point. I know that it gets equilibrium non-zero value from this. Then if I try to disturb this magnetization, it costs some energy. I'm just putting that information. In principle, I could get higher order terms to the power of 4 and so on. But I'll be satisfied by looking at what are the consequences of this simple chain. Now, this will be very interesting to study if I look at a magnet and close to a wall. Suppose I have a magnet, and in the surface I have a boundary condition which says the magnetization vanishes at the boundary, suppose. Then I can use this equation and then minimize this. Previously, I minimized with respect to one variable. Now I minimize with respect to a configuration. Then I will find that consistent with, suppose I look at the magnetization equilibrium value at a given temperature as a function of, let's say, position. Let's say I have a magnet like this. I look at it along the x-axis. This is my magnet. I have a boundary condition which says that the magnetization is 0 here. Then I will find that if I plot a curve, the simple thing, it reaches the equilibrium value in some fashion. And now it defines some characteristic length in which it relaxes back to the equilibrium value. That length you will find is related to correlation length that you see in mean field theory that we calculated before. So this is a very powerful equation which can handle situations where things vary in space, typically what happens close to a surface. And in fact, many interesting things happen. In reality, you have, these are all, as we said before, they are all vectors. Then you can imagine topological structures. For example, a simple domain wall. That is, I have a magnet in which close to the boundary it's up, and as move away, it goes down. Then there is a domain wall. And then depends on whether my magnetization is a very simple vector or it's a scalar. So I can create so-called topological configurations. I can create vertices, I can create vertex lines, I can create monopoles, and all kinds of beautiful things are hiding behind this very simple Landau free energy, depending on what you specialize, whether you have a vector or whether you have a complex M and so on. Okay. Now, the next thing I just wanted to specify is that you can use this and then elevate it to a Boltzmann factor. That is, now I do not know the microscopic of a ferromagnet, let's say like yttrium ion garnet. I have no idea about the microscopic Hamiltonian, but I can write down with some help from experiment an expression like this, where I know An, A1 from experiment, I know Tc from experiment, I know lambda from experiment by fitting. Then I can use this experimental input to build a powerful theory which will describe like critical phenomena and critical exponents very accurately. In fact, this is what we do in physics. In physics, we often, you know, in our mind, coarse grain and pick up relevant variables. Suppose I want to study the dynamics of this chalk piece. So I don't go to atomic degree of freedom. For me, as far as this dynamics of this chalk piece is concerned, what is the first important thing is the mass. The second thing is the moment of inertia. It's not a sphere, so it has moment of inertia, something which is different here. Then with that, I can study the dynamics, how I throw it and what happens. Then if I'm interested in a balloon filled with water, then it's not a rigid body. It's an incompressible fluid for as a first approximation, but the balloon can deform. Then the physics of describing a balloon filled with water becomes more complicated. I'll have to look at other corresponding variable, which corresponds to shapes of the surface. It becomes like a field theory. So here I have just gone from simple uniform magnetization to now. It's remarkable, lots of solutions of this equation when you minimize it is hiding here. I mean, I always wonder when I look at, when you listen to friends talking about general relativity, Einstein's equation is an equation like an Euler-Lagrange equation. You take some action and minimize it. Even Einstein did not suspect that it's going to have Friedman solution, a solution which in which things start with a big bang and growth. So in the same way, the equation, the free energy that Landau wrote down, and also Ginzburg-Landau wrote down, contains beautiful physics, possibility of vortex solutions, quantized vortices, and many, many things. Okay. Now, for us from statistical mechanics point of view, how do I elevate it to the level of Gibbs factor, and how do I calculate thermodynamic averages? It's very simple. So already we saw it in the case of simple example of spins with long range interaction. So this is what I do. So I say that I have, let me go back again to Heisenberg. Now I have to do a functional integral, because now I have forgotten about my origin of spins. There are spins are sitting at, they are tied to atoms. The distance between two atoms is of the order of a few angstrom unit. So I have in some mind coarse grained, I look at bigger volume, maybe nanometer scale, and then define some average value of magnetization. And a phenomenological say that their energy or free energy has this particular form, because this works very well in understanding first order phase transition, second order phase transition. Now I say that that is my free energy density. Now my partition function is a functional integral of that is, I take this action, put some form of m of r, then evaluate this, and then put a different form of m of r. So I sum over all possible functions m of r with a constraint. So this is the partition function. So now it looks like field theory that you are doing in the previous class. And it may enjoy some invariance. It may not look like Lorentz invariance theory. And there is no time. So it looks like an Euclidean action. But there is a scalar field in this case. So this is what, for example, in the context of renormalization group theory, this is what you will play with while trying to understand critical phenomena and critical exponents. So let me again say that this is a phenomenological partition function. Unlike when I started about interacting molecules and so on, I have some parameter A1, which is temperature itself temperature dependent, but I'm satisfied with it because I'm not going to use it for every temperature. For example, if you take a ferromagnet and heat it to a very high temperature, very solid iron will melt. Then this is no more a good description. So I'm focusing on phenomena close to critical point in the neighborhood. Then A1 is some parameter and others are parameters. Now I do this. So if I do this successfully, this partition function will give me all I wanted in principle. Okay. So this is, now it turns out you can also derive it starting with an Ising model in many ways. This will take us to Kardanov's block spin hypothesis, as well as rewriting Ising model partition function in this particular way. So let me motivate it in one or two steps, and then I will go to the next thing that I wanted to do. So you notice that the Ising model had spins like this. J. So I could rewrite it as SA minus SJ plus some constant. Okay. Now you know that if you have variable on a lattice, phi I minus phi J, if the variable is slowly varying in space, I can replace it by a gradient. You can do it. But That is, if you're thinking about a variable which is a continuous variable. Here I have a variable which is unfriendly. It's either plus 1 or minus 1. So how do I do it? So there are many ways to do it. And one successful way is, when you look at the partition function, okay, let it go up. When you look at the partition function, I have a discrete summation. For example, if I take variable I plus or minus 1. This is a problem, actually, if you think deeply about it. The mathematical problem associated with evaluating partition function is because you are dealing with discrete variable. So you'll have to do combinatorics, you'll have to do complicated sum. So if I want to think about it, this, let's say I have some f of s. I can imagine doing it, doing an integral, but doesn't help much. They're identical, you will agree. Because the delta function I have will pick up s equal to plus 1 and minus 1. And otherwise, it will. But delta function, you know, when you look at a simple single spin, quantum mechanics tells me that it's a two-level system. I can have up spin or down spin, nothing else. But if I'm going to look at magnetization, which I measure experimentally, I am actually doing some averaging in my mind over a large number of spins. So the effective spin is going to be a continuous degree of freedom. So what I can do is, I can become a little lenient and say that I will relax this hardcore constraint of delta function. Because if you look at in terms of graph, this looks like this. It takes value minus 1. This is a delta function. But suppose I can replace it by something like this. It should still work. That is, the error I am making in getting some universal quantities should be 0. So how do I do that? So that is where representation of delta function, that you know that delta function can be represented by limit some sigma width of a Gaussian goes to 0. That is, you make the width narrower and narrower, the value at the origin will keep going up, and the width of the distribution will shrink, so that the product of that is unity. So now I can do this trick. So I can replace this by a with some prefactor here. Now you already start seeing a pi 4 theory coming here, because if I expand it, I have minus a square by 2 sigma square plus s to the power of 4. Yeah. That's it, plus a constant term. In other words, this way of regularizing a delta function, which is very sharp by this soft means, immediately tells me that instead of this hard, you know, constraint, I have a soft constraint, which gives me like a Gaussian term plus a quartic term. So now if I go back to my Ising model, which I wrote it in that, I can continue to make it look like this. Then I have got, so let's see. But pardon me for not keeping track of the factors. So you'll get something like Tc times s square plus some lambda s to the power of 4. So this two have come from the delta function constraint. Now I have a soft spin. Now, assuming that this new variable, soft variables, are slowly varying when I'm in an ordered state, I can replace it by a gradient. So notice that just by starting with the Ising model and being a little lenient, replacing a delta function constraint on the spin variable by a softer constraint, which of course gives me a parameter. I will keep it in mind. What is remarkable is the end result for critical phenomena in terms of exponents and so are independent of the sigma. There is no formal proof for it, but this is what happens in practice. So so this is one way of converting Ising model problem into a field theory. But there are other ways, using what is called a Hubbard-Stratonovich transformation. I will not do that. Okay. So now what is clear here is that dealing with microscopic variables in terms of spins and other electron degree of freedom may be a luxury, may not be necessary to understand many properties that we are looking for and many properties that comes from experiment. So we may be able to go to degrees of freedom which are more collective. In the case of liquid and gas, we simply didn't care about fluctuations, including van der Waals theory. We simply bothered about mean density. And then we found out what is the relation between that and pressure. Now, the standard gas and liquid that we look at are not critical. They are away from critical points, so that description is OK. But now we are interested in looking at critical phenomena. So this is where Kadanoff's beautiful insight came. He said that one extreme is organize all the degree of freedom into one collective variable, like Landau did. That's not good for critical phenomena. It may show the existence of a critical point, but it will give you wrong critical exponents and wrong understanding of nature of fluctuations and so on. So what he said was, let me slowly build the problem. This is related to this beautiful idea of block spin construction. That is, I don't coarse grain at one step and say that here is my free energy, here is my magnetization averaged in some volume, then here are my parameters. This is fine. But I want to do it a little better. So what Kadanoff said was that particularly when you are trying to understand critical phenomena, there are fluctuations at all length scales. So the notion of a collective magnetization being the only important variable is wrong. So there are things happening at different scale. So he said, let us look at the problem hierarchically. So Kadanoff, this is a famous block spin construction of Kadanoff. I will describe it in words, and then I will explicitly do one-dimensional model today. So if I am deep in the ordered state, you will agree with me that most of the time, these four spins will be parallel. Occasionally, there may be thermal fluctuations, if you think in terms of fluctuations. So I can imagine tying them and building one collective variable, which is either up or down. So there are 2 times 2 times, so 2 to the power of 4, 16 configurations possible. But only 2 configurations will dominate, namely all spins up or all spins down. And if I am in the ordered state in which the order is fixed to be in one direction, basically, this configuration will dominate, like this configuration having one spin down will be way down. So he said that, let me construct new variable corresponding to this block. And then so I will have similar block. So it's a kind of coarse graining, but done at atomic scale. So now I have a new variable. Original Ising model had a partition function, let's say J by KBT. Now, in terms of this new variable, I can imagine, I can ask the question, how the Hamiltonian will look like. So it is going to be, the interaction is going to be different because the spins act along the boundary, and there are more spins here. So you can say that this new spin will be J prime. And I will evaluate J prime for a very specific model, and then we'll come back to it. Okay, then having done that, I can imagine a new lattice in which I consider this as a block spin. That is, I got 4 spins, I put them together and form a new. So I can keep doing it. And then if I am at the critical point, this construction should work very well. And then I will show explicitly that it will be able to write down a relation after some approximation, how the free energy will start looking like at different length scales. And that alone gives you beautiful information about critical phenomena. So to appreciate this, let us do our dear one-dimensional model in some detail. And I'm doing this because this can be done exactly. So I have a one-dimensional spin system. Spins, so I have an Ising model which, so somehow I want to block these two spins and want to find out how this block couples to the next block and what is the relevant degree of freedom and how the coupling, so while the coupling between two spins is J, how the coupling is between two blocks, block spin. There are many ways of doing it using what is called decimation. But what I will do is I will follow transfer matrix approach. Because you have learned that a simple Ising model has so this is the transfer matrix, let's call it PS. So it's same thing happens. So from every site, basically, you have this, from the next site, and so on. And then finally, you take the trace. This is something you have learned very well. Now what I do is anticipating some interesting behavior. So what I do is I take this product of these two neighboring transfer matrices. Nothing prevents me from doing it. So I take the product. Then I will get some complicated mess. But now I have simple 2x2 matrix. It turns out you can ask the question, can I rewrite it as some J prime? That is, after taking this product, I again get 2x2 matrix, beta J prime. So this J prime is going to be a function of the old J and the beta. Because they're all the two, I have not even applied magnetic field. Okay. So in this case, you can explicitly get the relation between the new J prime because you can rewrite it in this particular form. That you can rewrite it in this form, just obvious. In fact, it is very obvious when you explicitly look at it like this. That is, you can rewrite. Let's say it's spin I plus 1. You know that this can be written as cosh beta j plus si plus 1. This is all you know that. That is, you expand it in powers of si times si plus 1. Since that product can be either plus or minus 1, all the odd powers and even powers joined together comes you cosh and sine hyperbolic, and leaving you this. Now, if I take this, two such things, si plus 1, si plus 2. Now, what I do is, so that means the corresponding factor here will be cos. So now I want to take the trace over this variable si plus 1. Because I'm just basically summing over this intermediate. So I have three sides, i plus 1, I plus 2. So I want to take that, and which I can immediately do. You will notice that when you take the trace, this term will be there, cos square, or in fact, the way normally you do is you pull down this cosh and they have a tan hyperbolic. Sorry about it. You notice that this term, that is a product of this and this, will give you plus Si, and we know that Si plus 1 square is 2, is 1. Then there will be terms which will contain and then another term containing now something beautiful happens. When you take the trace over Si plus 1, this will not matter. Whereas this is odd in Si plus 1, this is also odd in Si plus 1. So it will take plus and minus 1, it exactly cancels. So you are back to the form in which you have 1 plus, sorry, so you have basically gotten the old form you had, except that tan hyperbolic beta j is replaced by square of tan hyperbolic beta. So that means now we can rewrite this as in terms of a j prime. And you know the analytic connection between j and j prime. So in the next class, we will take that and see how you proceed along this line. You get beautiful ideas of fixed point and behavior close to the fixed point. Now, one dimension is a luxury, because if you think about it, things are so tuned that at each level, the effective Hamiltonian I get is identical. It's again interaction between two neighbors, and the effective spin is 1, as plus or minus 1, except that the magnitude gets renormalized at every step. But otherwise, the form is invariant. And this is no more true when you go to two-dimensionalizing model. What we will see is that when we do this block spinning, you start with nearest neighbor coupling, and then you will generate next nearest neighbor coupling, you will generate four spin couplings, and so on. So in some sense, what is happening is something very interesting. You had a parameter space which is just nearest neighbor coupling, and then you try to look at it at a different length scale, you get this nearest neighbor coupling, which becomes J prime. And then you start generating new coupling, let me call it as a K1 and K2. In the case of 2D-dimensionalizing model, this K1 will correspond to next nearest neighbor coupling, K2 will correspond to four spin coupling, for example. Let me call it as 4. So this was 0 to begin with, and you have generated. Whereas in the case of 1D-dimensionalizing model, just everything is 0. You just flow down. Now this gives a very nice picture that it is as if there is some parameter space, you can call it as K1, K2, and J, and then you start from some point. Let's say you basically start from some point here in which everybody else is 0, and then as you renormalize, you have some flow. Now, in practice, this space will be multidimensional. The dimension will keep growing in reality, but in practice, it may be sufficient if you project it to some lower dimension, and then you can get very accurate and approximate information. Yes.
Could you repeat what these two zeros mean in one dimension and K1, K4?
Okay. So let me first go to in the two-dimensional model. I started with Ising spins with nearest neighbor interaction. Next nearest neighbor interactions were absent. Now, if I do the renormalization, which I have not done, you will find that the block spins not only coupled to their neighbors, this block spin also coupled to their next neighbor. So this is the next neighbor diagonally. So it will generate the first step a small term. Similarly, you will also find it generates a term which contains four spins. S1, suppose this is the blocks I'm looking at. I will get a coupling which involves S2, S3, S4. But all these couplings that are generated will respect the original symmetry of the problem if I do it correctly. But however, the problem gets more complicated. Even two-spin interaction in 2-dimension is hard to handle. By renormalization procedure, we generate four spin interactions and so on. But we will see that in some sense, those things are not very important to understand critical phenomena. That is where all this. So this is something I will do. But I illustrated this simple example in 1-dimension because where this complication doesn't exist. Because you don't have nearest neighbor coupling, and you do this combining of these two transfer matrix, you get back same structure, except that J is modified by J prime. And it keeps going on. So 1-dimension is a luxury, but it already can teach you a lot. You can calculate so-called beta functions, and you can get many, many nice insights. When you come to 2-dimension, it turns out this kind of playing with real space works remarkably well, gets some good insight. But it doesn't get exponents correct. Then it stops there. Now, if you want to study D dimension and other things, then you go back to that free energy expression and functional integral representation of partition function in terms of this collective variable magnetization, not in terms of microscopic spin. And to deal with that, we will see in detail, and David will do that. You'll have to go to momentum. It's exactly like scattering problem of field theory. That is, that tells you some fields which, in the absence of the lambda term, is free. They are Gaussian theory. So they are free bosons running around. Then this lambda to the power of 4 term gives you interactions like this. And the question is, how do you organize them? And how do you sum them to get good insight into the critical phenomena? So that is where you will hear about 4 minus epsilon and 1 over epsilon. Many approximate methods are there. And it gives very good insight. The very, very important insight will be that critical phenomena is, in some sense, trivial above 4 dimension. That is, all the exponents that you get from mean field theory is exact. Whereas when you come below 4 dimension, things become bad. So there are 4 minus epsilon and various methods. So I hope I have given you some idea saying that you started with a collective variable. Like in liquid gas theory, you just worry about density. You don't worry about spatial variation. And we can do the same thing with any order parameter. It could be magnetization, it could be polarization, it could be orientation of this NH4 molecule. And you can do a beautiful Landau theory and get information about second order, first order transition, tricritical point, there's things called tetracritical point, and so on. But that is not good enough to understand critical phenomena very well and bring universality and so on. Then you can, one way is to elevate Landau's approach into a path integral, functional integral, integrating over configurations of relevant order parameter field, in our case, magnetization. Or you can take Kadanoff's approach, saying that you start with a spin problem, think about coarse graining in a microscopic way. That is, go to the Boltzmann factor and integrate over, construct collective spins by what this is called decimation, or do some trick, which I will do explicitly tomorrow. And then see how the new degree of freedom at large and large scale, how do they look like? How do they interact? And we will find that at the critical point, they start looking identical. That is, at every scale, the Hamiltonian of the system, the renormalized Hamiltonian looks identical. So I illustrated that through this simple 1-dimensional. I have not illustrated completely. I just set up a program which gives you confidence that you can do things analytically and exactly in 1-dimension. It will already take you a long way. Then when you go to 2-dimension, things become complicated. But however, we can capture it in this picture. It is as if there is a space of coupling constants. And your initial Hamiltonian, your initial action is some very special point lying in one axis. And as you do this renormalization, you flow. So without having to know the detailed trajectory, you know that this kind of recursion leads to so-called fixed points. Things may flow to some specific fixed point, and there may be limit cycles, and all kinds of complicated things are possible in this recursion program. And that's going to help us understand critical phenomena. and even approximately. I think this is what I will do next. So I'll be happy to answer any questions if you have.
Yes.
So the flow that we've drawn there, in fact, since we are doing steps, of course, then it will be discrete.
Okay, thank you.
So when I did it, I changed the lattice parameter, let's say. When I go from one lattice parameter here, this is the new lattice parameter. So it's a discrete step. So what I have is a discrete renormalization group. But as you can imagine, as you go to larger and larger steps, you can imagine these steps to form a continuum. But in fact, there is a program called continuous renormalization group, which is surprisingly possible even in two dimension in a square, in a triangular lattice. So one of the beautiful work in this field, old paper by Hillhoth, Schick, and von Luyen, where they take Ising model in two dimension and then do some clever tricks, something called star triangle transformation, and then construct a renormalization group flow in some continuum parameter. It's not a discrete step. So in principle, it is possible. And I believe you could do it in one dimension. So it's a very important point. That is, at the moment, I have a discrete step. If I were to start with the continuum theory, you can imagine, because in continuum theory, there is no lattice parameter. There is some ultraviolet cutoff. But I can imagine doing scaling the lattice or time space continuously, and I will get differential equations. So here I will get recursion relations between nth and n plus 1 step. But as you go approach the critical point, these recursion relations can be approximated by some nonlinear differential equations.
Okay. So there are no questions. Thank you.